This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Greetings, listeners. For Radio Reading Services, I am Greg Salins, reading the Wall Street Journal for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. There are six stories on today's front page. First, Sony and Apollo make $26 billion all-cash offer for Paramount. Apple sales fall on sluggish iPhone and China businesses. Colleges have a new source of protest on their hands, irate parents. Inside RFK Jr.'s chaotic White House bid. Europe takes radical steps to boost production. And how an ordinary guy took a $3,000 case to the Supreme Court. Our first story, Sony and Apollo make $26 billion all-cash offer for Paramount. This article is by Jessica Tunkel and Miriam Gottfried. Sony Pictures and private equity firm Apollo Global Management have submitted an all-cash $26 billion offer for Paramount Global, the latest twist in one of the messiest deal dramas in recent memory. Apollo and Sony on Wednesday submitted the offer letter, which was signed by Sony Pictures chief executive Tony Vinciquerra and Aaron Sobel, a partner at Apollo, according to people familiar with the situation. The offer is a starting point for discussions and is non-binding. The joint bid comes as Paramount had been in exclusive merger talks with Skydance Media, a production company led by David Ellison. A number of shareholders have protested the Skydance offer, which they said gave controlling shareholder Sherry Redstone a sweetheart deal for her stake in National Amusements, the company through which she controls Paramount. The company has since parted ways with CEO Bob Bakish, and four of its directors decided to leave. Bakish and at least one of the directors voiced concerns over the Skydance deal. Both Skydance and Paramount entered into exclusive negotiations over a deal last month, but that exclusivity period runs out at the end of Friday, meaning Paramount and Redstone can open up sales discussions with other possible suitors. Under the terms of Sony and Apollo's offer, Sony would become the significant majority shareholder, with Apollo taking a minority stake and ceding operational control, the people said. The offer includes assumption of Paramount's debt, which stands at $14.6 billion, according to FactSet. Paramount shares closed 13% higher on Thursday. Apollo had earlier submitted a $26 billion offer for Paramount, including about $12 billion in equity plus assumption of debt. But days after it did, members of Paramount's board opted to enter exclusive merger discussions with Skydance. The board had concern about Apollo's bid, including whether it could arrange financing for a deal. Apollo earlier had sought to buy Paramount's movie studio, for which it offered $11 billion. The battle for Paramount comes as the company, home of the eponymous movie studio, the broadcaster CBS, and cable channels like Nickelodeon and MTV, is facing strong headwinds. The collapse of the cable TV industry has hammered it, and its struggle to find a profitable path in the new streaming world has only compounded its troubles. Paramount also finds itself in high-stakes negotiations to ensure carriage of its cable channels by Spectrum parent Charter Communications, which recently became the nation's biggest pay TV company by subscribers. The deal with Charter, which was scheduled to expire at the end of April, has been extended while the two companies attempt to hash out a deal. Charter is pushing to offer the Paramount Plus streaming service for free to all of its customers, part of a strategy that it previously adopted during negotiations with Disney last year. Paramount's market value has plummeted since Redstone years ago won a nasty battle to succeed her father, the irascible media mogul Sumner Redstone. The stock price decline dealt a multi-billion-dollar blow to her family's fortune. Redstone started seriously entertaining selling National Amusements last year after the October 7th attacks on Israel pushed her to want to spend more time fighting anti-Semitism. In December, she met with Ellison, the CEO of Skydance Media and son of billionaire Larry Ellison. Over lunch, the younger Ellison described Skydance's business, whose credits include TV shows such as Amazon's Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan and Apple TV Plus's Foundation, and movies like Top Gun Maverick. Skydance also has sports venture with the NFL, an animation studio, and a gaming division. He also laid out his vision for the company: invest more in Paramount, restructure costs, and improve Paramount's data and analytics to better compete with Netflix. Redstone later sent Ellison's proposal to the board. Beyond Skydance, Sony, and Apollo, other parties have expressed interest in Paramount in recent months, including Warner Brothers Discovery and media executive Byron Allen. The structure of the proposed Skydance deal, which would require Skydance to buy out National Amusements in cash, and then in a second step be acquired by Paramount with stock, caused a revolt among Paramount shareholders. Some of them voiced concerns in letters to the board that the deal would be good for Redstone, but would dilute Paramount's non-voting shareholders. Bakish, Paramount's then CEO, told people close to him he had concerns about the Skydance transaction, the Journal has previously reported. He and his management team worked to find an alternative, floating a plan to raise equity capital to buy out all voting shareholders in Paramount, including Redstone. On Monday, Paramount announced it had parted ways with Bakish, putting in place an Office of the CEO made up of divisional heads. Skydance on Sunday proposed a revised offer that would put $3 billion on Paramount's balance sheet and give non-voting shareholders a premium in Paramount Skydance stock merger, the Journal previously reported. Our next story: Apple sales fall as iPhone and China businesses remain sluggish. This article is by Aaron Tilley. Apple's revenue declined for the fifth time in the past six quarters, dragged down by ailing iPhone sales and new competition from smartphone rivals in China. Still, shares of Apple rose more than 7% in aftermarket trading as the company authorized $110 billion in stock buybacks and signaled that the current quarter is likely to see revenue growth. And while sales and profits fell in March quarter, the numbers were slightly better than analyst expectations. Apple is struggling on a number of fronts. The company's single most important business, the iPhone, has faced sluggish growth. In recent years, Apple has seen success by steering consumers toward its more expensive Pro-designated phones. Its latest iPhone 15 Pro Max was its most expensive ever, with a starting price of $1,200. But this premium strategy isn't propping up overall revenue as much as it did in the past. For the first 3 months of the year, Samsung reclaimed the number one spot for worldwide smartphone market share, according to research firm IDC. Apple's iPhone unit shipments slipped nearly 10% for the quarter over the previous year, while the total smartphone market expanded about 8% annually. Apple had briefly become the number one smartphone vendor near the end of 2023. In the most recent quarter, iPhone sales declined 10.5% from the prior year to $46 billion, in line with analyst projections. Some investors said they had expected declines in revenue in the quarter, but these results weren't as bad as anticipated. The main thing we're looking for is some form of stability in the hardware and iPhone, said Charles Reinhart, chief investment officer at Johnson Investment Counsel, an Apple shareholder. The iPhone is down a bit, but it held on to their profitability. Challenging conditions in China, Apple's third largest market, have been an area of concern for many shareholders. Huawei, China's homegrown champion, has rapidly been gaining ground since getting back into high-end phones. In China, Huawei's smartphone sales rocketed up nearly 70% from the previous year, while Apple's sales fell 19%, according to Counterpoint Research. The Chinese government has been encouraging this trend. Late last year, the Chinese government imposed bans on the iPhone for government officials in the workplace. China is the most competitive market in the world, and we feel confident about our position, said Luca Maestri, Apple's chief financial officer, in an interview. Chief executive Tim Cook appeared to push back against external estimates showing declines in iPhone sales in China. Apple's overall revenue in what it calls Greater China fell by 8% to $16.4 billion. Cook said that iPhone grew in mainland China for the quarter. He didn't provide detailed financial or sales figures. The Greater China region includes mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau. Slowing Chinese demand has played a role in previous slumps for Apple. In the company's fiscal 2016 and 2019, sales in its Greater China unit declined 17.41% and 15.91% respectively. We did not foresee the magnitude of the economic deceleration, particularly in Greater China, Cook wrote to investors in early 2019. For the quarter, Apple sales were $90.75 billion, down 4.3% from the prior year, and profit fell 2.2% to $23.6 billion. Revenue from Apple services business, which includes Apple Store sales and subscription revenue from music, TV, and other offerings, grew 14.2% to $23.87 billion. Apple says it expects overall sales growth in the April to June quarter to be in the low single digits percentage-wise. The company didn't disclose over what period it would buy back the $110 billion in shares. Apple has repurchased around $20 billion in shares per quarter since 2018. Antitrust enforcers in the U.S. and Europe have also ramped up scrutiny of Apple's competitive position in the market. In March, the Justice Department sued Apple, alleging the company maintains an illegal monopoly over the U.S. smartphone market. In Europe, new laws threaten to tear down Apple's closed app ecosystem, and the regional antitrust regulator has opened investigations into Apple's compliance with the new law. Apple plans to defend itself against these regulatory efforts. Apple's only new device in years, the Vision Pro, is many years from contributing meaningfully to company sales. The company in February canceled its electric vehicle project, laying off 614 workers. Some employees were shifted toward work on generative artificial intelligence, technology popularized by OpenAI's ChatGPT. With investors, Cook has promised to unveil new AI innovations within the company's ecosystem, which analysts believe will happen at its annual June Developers Conference. We also see incredible breakthrough potential for generative AI, which is why we're currently investing significantly in this area, Cook said at the company's recent annual shareholder meeting. In addition to Apple's own AI developments, the company is also potentially looking at external partnerships with Google and OpenAI. Artificial intelligence has been fueling tech earnings of late. Last week, shares of Microsoft and Google parent Alphabet jumped as the companies reported that they were spending billions to meet the growing demand for artificial intelligence in their products. Meta Platforms, on the other hand, underwent its worst day for stock in 18 months last week after the company announced a $10 billion capital expenditure projections for 2024 as it builds out its AI capabilities. Earlier this year, Microsoft took the crown from Apple as the world's largest company by market capitalization, and its lead has grown in the months since. Microsoft's stock is trading up 5% from the beginning of the year, while Apple's stock is down 10% in the same period. Investors are hopeful that these AI announcements will lead to renewed iPhone sales after a disappointing sales cycle with the latest iPhone 15. The last three iPhones have not been exciting, said Hal Edens, vice president at Apple Investor Capital Investment Companies. But hopefully with the iPhone 16, they roll out new AI features, and it will be off to the races. Our next story. Colleges have new source of protest on their hands. Irate parents. This article is by Claire Ansberry, Owen Adoyan, and Catherine Hamilton. Colleges already have a student revolt on their hands. Now their parents are rebelling too. Parents paying as much as $90,000 for their sons and daughters to attend elite universities are angry and frustrated with colleges' responses to the Gaza protests on both sides of the political divide. Whether their kids are protesting, counter-protesting, or try to stay out of it, parents are demanding that schools do more to keep them safe and learning. They're not getting the education they expected and paid for, says Zev Guros, a Boston real estate lawyer whose daughter is a senior at Barnard College in New York City. Parents are preparing to push back financially. They are requesting tuition refunds where classes have been canceled and contacting college counselors to ask how to get their money back. Parents are also threatening not to donate in the future. College officials say they are trying to keep students safe, adding security measures while also trying to respect students' rights to demonstrate. But tensions have exploded in the last few days. The tensions are further fraying the relationship between colleges and parents. They add to a drumbeat from more familiar questioning families questioning the value and hefty price tag of a college education. This reevaluation is especially significant for college seniors whose 4 years were disrupted by COVID. Gerwes said his daughter at Barnard was scheduled to deliver her final thesis this week, followed by a luncheon. The public presentation and guest lunch were canceled, along with in-person classes. Gerwes says he is writing a letter to the school's president, criticizing what he views as the school's inadequate response to what he describes as hate speech. In the meantime, Gerwes texts his daughter several times a day. I try to tell her that this is not her fault and that she is living in a moment in history and needs to keep her head high, he says. Barnard, where the estimated cost to attend this academic year is about $90,000, said that many of us are disappointed by the restrictions and cancellations as the semester ends. Other parents say the schools haven't done enough to protect the protesters. Sarah Fanning's daughter was taking a final when some of her peers, who were participating in an encampment, were arrested at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. To charge them with trespassing when they pay to live there is ridiculous, Fanning said. The university, which said 12 arrests were made, including 9 students, said it doesn't seek punitive action towards its students. Fanning, who lives in Alexandria, Virginia, has written emails to school administrators asking them to apologize to the students and allow them to peacefully protest. While she hasn't received any responses, Fanning is reconsidering donating to the school in the future. If the administration publicly supports the students, she would donate more. But escalation against the students would make her less inclined to give, she says. Events that do not follow instructions, attempt to disrupt classes or activities, or endanger the health, safety, and security of our campus community will not be allowed, UMW President Troy Pano said. Part of families' ire stems from the years of work that many put in even before college, with well-off parents hiring tutors and counselors to try to boost their children's chances of landing a spot at a coveted university. Christopher Rim, founder and CEO of Command Education, a company that helps students complete competitive college applications, says that in the past week, he has received calls from about 25 parents with students at Columbia University and the University of California, Los Angeles, both sites of demonstrations in recent days. Some wanting full or partial refunds from the colleges their kids attend. Physically blocking their child from attending class or a lecture is 100% not what they signed up for, Rim said. They are beyond upset at what is going on. Parents are also trying to figure out how much guidance to give their kids about navigating what's happening on campus. Kim Gilio, whose son is a sophomore at UCLA, is in a Facebook group with other parents of students there. They are sending in screenshots of conversations with their children, updating each other about what's happening on campus, and making calls to the chancellor as they grow frustrated with the university's response, she said. For her part, though, she is trying not to get overly involved. She hasn't reached out to campus administrators and is trying not to say too much to her son. I'm trying to act as a safe place to have him share information without piling back in, she said. Deborah Lynn Eden says she receives several texts a day from her daughter, a junior at Princeton, describing protests that were largely peaceful until this week when students were arrested. Though her daughter isn't involved in protests, Eden fears that the tensions on campus are causing stress, and Eden is encouraging her to stay away from the action and avoid any media on campus. It's all a giant distraction to the students who are trying to complete their studies in a high-stress environment, Eden said. Lana Shammy's daughter is graduating from the University of Southern California, which has canceled its large main stage ceremony, commencement ceremony. Shammy is flying to Los Angeles anyway with her other family members for the graduation, which they will mark by going out to dinner and inviting some of her daughter's friends to go along. There will be no celebration at the university where we paid an exorbitant amount of tuition for the past 4 years, she said. It's a huge letdown. Our next story. Inside RFK Jr.'s chaotic White House bid. This article is by Rebecca Ballhaus and Eliza Collins. As the presidential election was heating up in February, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s campaign made an announcement to staff. Charles Eisenstein, the director of messaging, would spend weeks in Costa Rica reconnecting with spirit. While there, he recorded a podcast interview in which he said some of his boss's ideas were actually repugnant, but that Kennedy was still the best candidate. In recognition of his sojourn in the Central American country, Eisenstein took a pay cut for working less. Rather than earning $21,000 a month, he started billing the campaign $14,000. The episode highlights the unusual nature of the Kennedy operation, which even by the standards of freewheeling political campaigns, stands out for its eclectic mix of characters, poor financial planning, and what some staffers describe as dysfunctional, unprofessional atmosphere. Kennedy, 70 years old, has surrounded himself with aides and advisors who have little political experience, and in some instances, histories that might have raised eyebrows on other campaigns. Former staffers complain that some top officials are more focused on raising their own profiles than helping the candidate, among other concerns. As a result of the disorder, several people have quit. I had felt left behind by both parties and thought someone like RFK could be the answer, said Kira Hall, who left the campaign recently and said she doesn't know whom she will vote for. Kennedy's campaign was rife with grifters and opportunists, she said. If someone's going to do that to their campaign, how do I know they won't do that in their administration? This account of the Kennedy campaign's inner workings is based on interviews with more than a dozen current and former staffers and campaign texts and emails viewed by the Wall Street Journal. You can dig all you want, but the bottom line is we're a group of intelligent, committed, and successful professionals who have already made history, Kennedy spokesman Stephanie Speer said in a statement, adding that the campaign would continue to surprise mainstream media and that the two-party establishment. She didn't respond to a list of detailed inquiries. In some ways, the campaign embodies Kennedy, who has promoted conspiracy theories, in particular on vaccines, and espouses political views from across the spectrum. Kennedy largely aligns with Democratic policies, but is more in line with Republicans on such topics as immigration and guns. He also recently indicated he would be open to pardoning Donald Trump's supporters who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, a promise that Trump has made. Several staff and consultants on the Kennedy campaign were either at the Capitol on January 6, made sympathetic comments about those convicted, or questioned the results of the 2020 election. Kennedy's independent campaign might be easily dismissed, but for the impact it is having on the presidential race. Democrats and Republicans alike are concerned that a scion of one of America's most storied political families could draw votes from their respective candidates, potentially determining the outcome of the election. Kennedy has made it onto the ballot in a few states so far, though his campaign and a super PAC supporting him have said they have met requirements in several others. Polls, including a recent Wall Street Journal battleground survey, show he has low support overall. He generally pulls slightly more voters from Trump than President Biden, though he also draws key demographics such as young voters and Latinos. Kennedy has forcefully rejected notions that he will play the role of spoiler in the race. On Wednesday, his campaign called Biden the spoiler. Randall Economy, who was a senior advisor on ballot access until he was fired after a disagreement with senior staff in February, said the people Kennedy has surrounded himself with make his likelihood of success even slimmer. His team is letting him down, said Economy, a former talk show radio host in Palm Desert, California, who has advised campaigns, including the unsuccessful effort to recall California Governor Gavin Newsom. The Kennedy campaign includes family members and several people from his anti-vaccine group, Children's Health Defense. His communications director, Del Bigtree, runs another major anti-vaccine group and spoke at a rally a block from the Capitol on January 6th. Bigtree said in an email the event was dedicated to medical freedom and not to the election of President Trump. Some staff said others on the campaign told them they had first met Kennedy, who is sober, at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or recovery events. Many staffers called the candidate by his first name, an unusual informality in a presidential campaign. Aides at all levels also enjoy a remarkable amount of access to the candidate and have his personal contact information, allowing them to reach out directly to vent concerns or pitch ideas. Several staffers fear the electromagnetic radiation from microwave ovens complicating a volunteer potluck. People were advised to bring crockpots. The campaign has paid eye-popping salaries to some staffers with seemingly little experience, including an $8,000 a month fee for a digital strategist who graduated from high school in 2021. It has also paid more than $50,000 to a company run by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's half-brother, Kyle Kemper, who was such a big supporter that he decked out an RV with a huge picture of Kennedy and his political slogans and drove it up the East Coast. Upon learning about the RV, Kennedy contacted Kemper and invited him to his house to see the bus. A few months later, the campaign hired Kemper to work on volunteer and voter engagement. His duties included driving the RV around the country as it blasted songs from the 1960 campaign of Kennedy's uncle, John F. Kennedy, including a jingle by Frank Sinatra. "We are in startup mode," said Kemper, who is no longer on payroll, but still supports Kennedy. "There's going to be failures. There's going to be F-ups. There's going to be some drama. That always happens." Among those failures, platforms to reach voters via text message or email stopped working on several occasions because there weren't enough funds to pay vendors, former staffers said. The campaign has employed some unconventional fundraising efforts. AIDS launched a program that allows any supporter who raises more than $100 in donations to take a 10% cut of the haul. Some staffers worry the approach could invite legal problems, but Kennedy needs to pull out all the stops to raise money. He is burning through cash and legs well behind Biden and Trump in fundraising. The freewheeling style is also evident in the inner workings of the campaign, where some aides have shared confidential information or complained about strategy during widely attended Zoom calls with little regard as to who was listening. Top aides have dialed into calls from exotic locations, including Hawaii. One aide said he at times wondered whether he was still employed because he hadn't heard from anyone on the campaign in days. During the campaign's virtual Christmas party held over Zoom, Kennedy said that he was high before someone interrupted to clarify that the candidate had just left the dentist and was still feeling the effects of anesthesia, according to former aides who were on the call. Campaign staff have on their calendars an optional invite to Sunday prayer circles, where a reverend who heads the group that opposes vaccination requirements for children leads a prayer for Kennedy's divine protection. The campaign posts videos of the prayer circle on YouTube. A lot of us feel like we're in a movie all the time, said one former aide. The dysfunction, aide said, has manifested itself in an absence of strategy for appealing to Trump's or Biden's supporters. They said the campaign has made scant effort to understand either group of voters. Some top officials have privately dismissed Trump voters as extremists, while others have indicated they assumed that Kennedy's positions on COVID and vaccines would be enough to reel in the Trump voters without making further effort, former aides said. For a period, Fridays on the campaign came with rounds of resignations, many of them in letters that were blasted into an all-staff email list. At times, aides said, it felt as though staffers would disappear from one day to the next with no announcement. In October, Kristen Cramer, at the time the ballot access director, approached the campaign's human resources contractor to voice concerns about a man the campaign had hired to be her boss, Nick Brunna. Brunna faced public allegations of sexual harassment in 2021 that resulted in an investigation by board members of the Movement for a People's Party, a group headed by Brunna. In a statement at the time, Brunna confirmed the investigation and called the allegations false and politically motivated. Brunna didn't respond to requests for comment. Cramer, 50, told the HR firm that she didn't feel comfortable reporting to Brunna because of the allegations and said she was concerned about protecting young women on the campaign. The HR firm said it couldn't address her concerns in part because the allegations hadn't occurred on the Kennedy campaign. The campaign refused to even discuss it with me, she said. Cramer decided to start looking for another job. The campaign terminated her contract soon after, she said. Aide said the decision to hire Brunna was notable, given that the campaign's security specialist, Gavin DeBecker, a security consultant known for protecting Jeff Bezos and Madonna, conducts rigorous background checks into every employee. In a text message, DeBecker said the allegations were investigated and assessed by more than one employer. An aide who left last year said he had Googled other staffers and been alarmed by some of their histories. That included a Kennedy advisor, Jamel Hawley, a former local councilman who had been charged with ballot tampering more than a decade ago. Hawley didn't respond to a request for comment. Like many candidates, Kennedy engenders strong feelings of support among his staff, but several aides said their colleagues' commitment to the candidate was almost cult-like. It was a cult of personality more than traditional politics, said Cramer, the former ballot access director. Telling someone how wonderful a person is not the same as earning their vote. Some on the campaign believe that Kennedy is unlikely to win outright, but that he can siphon away enough support to stop Biden or Trump from winning the 270 electoral votes for victory. That would leave it to Congress to decide the winner. Some on Kennedy's team think lawmakers will pick him as the national savior because his major party rivals are so unpopular. The strategy is, to put it charitably, a stretch. No election has been sent to Congress since the 1800s. Some advisors have drawn consternation from staffers about whether they are promoting themselves more than Kennedy, particularly when they have publicly critiqued the candidate. Eisenstein, the director of messaging, speechwriter and advisor, has a Substack where he has outlined disagreements with Kennedy, hosts a monthly State of the World address over Zoom, and advertised a 5-day retreat he is hosting this month in North Carolina. On Wednesday, Eisenstein posted he was taking a break from the Substack for the remainder of Kennedy's campaign. Some staffers said they were particularly rankled by his comments given Eisenstein's high salary. Eisenstein said he was in Costa Rica, visiting an eco-village with his family and continued working. In an email, Eisenstein said, I am not going to say something I don't believe just to stay on message. People are sick of that kind of bull. Last fall, Eisenstein told other campaign aides that he had one foot out the door and would likely only remain if he could persuade Kennedy to take a stance that was more critical of Israel's invasion of Gaza, according to emails viewed by the Journal. At least one staffer raised concerns with Kennedy directly about the disruptive impact of Eisenstein's positions, according to the emails. Eisenstein said he considered leaving the campaign, but didn't issue an ultimatum. He said it was a positive sign that Kennedy doesn't surround himself only with yes-men. Our next story. Europe takes radical steps to boost production. There is no other option. This article is by Tom Fairless and Kim Mackerel in Flamanville, France. Early this year, a top European Union official made an eye-catching proposal, a 100 billion euro public fund that would curb Europe's reliance on U.S. defense manufacturers, who make nearly two-thirds of Europe's military hardware. The cash could subsidize European companies to develop and manufacture more weapons at home at a time when the continent faces a growing threat from Russia. Many officials were skeptical. For decades, the EU had been fighting European governments to limit state support for domestic companies. Now, one of the leaders was calling for taxpayers' money to finance them. The idea of such a large-scale funding for the defense industry is still under discussion. But in March, the bloc unveiled a 1.5 billion euro plan aimed at buying more of its defense equipment domestically. And when European leaders met soon after for a summit in Brussels, a central topic of their talks was how to boost funding further for the continent's defense industry and whether to do that through debt. The effort for the defense industry is just one example of Europe's new willingness to break long-standing taboos in a bid to build up domestic businesses. The EU is aiming to keep the continent's industrial base competitive with the US and China, whose governments are lavishing firms with hefty subsidies. At stake is Europe's manufacturing sector, the bedrock of its economy, which is losing ground in the race to build the industries of the future. Chinese electric car companies are starting to flood Europe with affordable EVs. Europe's share of global semiconductor production, critical for high-tech products including cars, is a fraction of that of the US or China. And the US is expected to surpass Europe in production of batteries by 2030, with China far ahead of both. Hamstrung by expensive energy, high interest rates, and anemic domestic demand, the cradle of the Industrial Revolution risks becoming a museum for rich Americans and Chinese tourists. The 100 billion euro defense fund was proposed by the EU's Internal Market Commissioner, Thierry Breton, a former tech CEO, theme park developer, and French finance minister, with a strong belief in the power of the state to shape the economy. In recent years, Breton has also helped steer new plans through the EU's slow-moving bureaucracy to allow European governments to match massive U.S. clean tech subsidies and to earmark billions in public money for the semiconductor industry. The efforts followed a spike in spending during the COVID-19 pandemic. The bloc's competition authority approved nearly 730 billion euro worth of crisis-related national subsidies during the 15 months ended in June 2023, although all the funds haven't been paid out, according to EU data. In the years before the pandemic, the total reported aid governments granted to businesses was in the range of 1 billion euro to 150 billion euro a year. We need now to take our destiny in our hands. There is no other option but to increase our capacity to produce more, Breton said in an interview at a French nuclear power plant in mid-March, where he was touring as part of plans to scale up nuclear production. The push to use public money to juice the economy marks a swerve away from decades of EU policy. The EU's bureaucracy had kept a tight leash on state aid since the 1980s. The European Commission, the closest thing the EU has to a government, with its antitrust powers and strict fiscal rules, has fought economic nationalism in European capitals, ensuring public subsidies didn't distort competition and undermine the interest of a half billion consumers. But in recent years, China's massive state-backed manufacturers have rapidly ascended the value chain and threatened high-tech European engineering and auto firms. The EU's share of global manufacturing shrank to around 16% in 2022, the last year available, from 24% in 2008, while China's share rose from 14% to 31% over the period, according to World Bank data. Meanwhile, the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, which among other things aims to tackle the climate crisis by investing in clean energy manufacturing, is luring international businesses with grants and subsidies worth as much as $1.2 trillion through 2032, about half of EU manufacturers' entire net annual output. At home, European manufacturers are being squeezed by high energy prices tied to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a costly transition to green energy from power plants that run on natural gas and coal, and endemic labor shortages. The Eurozone economy has stalled since mid-2022. I think I'm paying probably double the price of what a Chinese car manufacturer is paying in energy right now, said Luca De Meo, CEO of French automaker Renault. Oerlikon, a Swiss manufacturing company that makes surface coatings for tools and precision components with around 12,000 employees, said in December it would close its German factory and shift production to Huntersville, North Carolina. Europe is one of the most cost-intensive areas in the world, said Executive Chairman Michael Suess. The reaction of industries like ours is to look for the best framework conditions. Across France, Germany, and Italy, net foreign direct investment outflows totaled $82 billion in the first half of 2023, up from $53 billion 2 years earlier, according to OECD data. BASF said last year it would cut 2,600 jobs, mostly in Germany, even as it invests 10 billion euro in a state-of-the-art plant in China. It's very evident that something doesn't work, said Martin Brudermüller, who recently stepped down as CEO of the German chemicals giant in February. Breton, the most vocal proponent in Brussels of pumping billions of dollars of public money into critical European companies and sectors, is a rare EU bureaucrat to have hands-on business experience. As CEO of Thomson Multimedia in the late 1990s, he turned around the failing French state-controlled consumer electronics business by closing factories in the Midwestern U.S., moving American jobs to Mexico and later to China. Having built a reputation as a turnaround specialist, he went on to lead France Telecom, now Orange, an IT services company Atos. He also helped launch the Futuroscope theme park in central France and wrote several science fiction books. As France's finance minister, he oversaw a rare reduction in France's national debt to GDP ratio. "We were ahead of Germany when I left the government," he said. With his corporate experience, he says he knows how attractive new U.S. subsidies look to boards and that Europe needed to prepare a robust response. Breton built his profile at the European Commission as the Mr. Fix-It of the COVID-19 pandemic. His staff set up a map of production facilities with a role in the vaccine supply chain. He pounded factory floors and spoke to chief executives to try to loosen bottlenecks and keep supplies flowing. Around the same time, manufacturers across Europe and North America were wrestling with a shortage of chips, made mostly in East Asia and critical for goods ranging from cars to appliances. The U.S. quickly launched a plan called the CHIPS Act to boost semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. with tens of billions of dollars of subsidies. In response, Breton championed Europe's CHIPS Act, which took effect in 2023, aiming to double the EU's share of the global microchips market to 20% by channeling public money to the sector, making it easier for companies to access experimental production lines and supporting workforce training. "We did this in parallel with the U.S., Breton said in an interview earlier this year, but the program was no match for the $53 billion in direct financial support that the U.S. was offering. Even so, he suggested before the package was introduced that it was worth roughly the same as what was on offer in the U.S. Later, the commission said it expected the scheme to help mobilize public and private investments of more than 43 billion euro. In 2022, America's Inflation Reduction Act, which put billions of dollars of investments in play, caught the attention of clean tech industry executives in Europe. Peter Carlson, CEO of Sweden's Northvolt, the continent's biggest homegrown battery manufacturer, told CNBC in February of 2023 that he would soon unveil plans for a U.S. manufacturing plant, endangering Northvolt's earlier pledge to build a factory in Germany. At a meeting with bureaucrats in Brussels the following month, one executive after another rose to plead for the Commission to allow European governments to match the U.S. subsidies dollar for dollar. "We need immediately an IRA matching clause," said Thomas Schmall, Volkswagen board member responsible for technology, according to the event's organizers, a trade group. Breton and his colleague Margrethe Vestager, the EU's powerful antitrust commissioner and a skeptic of interventionist industry policy, were noncommittal, but their joint presence reassured executives that a grand bargain was within reach, one industry executive said. Officials say Breton pushed, along with France and Germany, for the matching aid clause to be approved. Days later, the EU said it would allow governments to match U.S. subsidies across a range of industry, potentially unlocking far more aid than the EU CHIPS Act. For Northvolt, the move opened the door to about 900 million euro in public money for its planned factory on Germany's North Sea coast. In January, Vestager greenlighted the funding, standing alongside German Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck, whose government will foot the bill. "There's certainly been a significant shift," said Patrick Anderson, Chief Strategy Officer at Northvolt. "The European reaction has been both swifter and more thorough than is often the case. Northvolt plans to build a first North American factory in Montreal and hasn't decided on further North American factories," a spokesman said. In March, the European Commission endorsed a plan that was championed by Breton to encourage European governments to move toward buying nearly half of their defense equipment domestically, including by encouraging large joint purchases. Initially, the Commission wants to set aside 1.5 billion euro to give governments a financial incentive for joint procurement and to offer subsidies to help companies produce more. Officials have said that much more would be needed to prop up domestic production. To fill that gap and support Ukraine in its fight against Russia, some European leaders have called for joint borrowing modeled on the bloc's roughly 800 billion euro pandemic recovery plan. For that fund, launched in 2021, the European Commission sells common bonds to international investors to finance public investment across the continent. Most major powers subsidize their defense industries, but a shift to large-scale funding at the EU level would mark a big change for the bloc. Breton wasn't the first EU leader to call for large-scale funding for defense, but his idea floated in January for a 100 billion euro defense fund resonated and helped set the agenda, an aide said. The proposal faces stiff opposition from some countries, including heavyweight Germany. Breton has, over the past year, toured ammunition factories and discussed defense funding with political leaders, keeping the debate alive. "He pushes outlandish ideas that might not materialize, but that shift the debate," a European diplomat said. The Frenchman's brash approach and tendency to favor speed over collaboration have frustrated some peers. "Breton doesn't give a damn about collegiality," one EU official said. An aide for Breton said he is a team player who works well with colleagues from various political parties. Breton has clashed recently with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who is campaigning for a second term in the role this year. He helped lead a revolt against her choice for a new small business envoy, resulting in the person's resignation in April. In March, he published a social media post suggesting that von der Leyen's political party lacked confidence in her. The rise of Breton, a confidant of French President Emmanuel Macron, coincides with the broader ascendancy of French economic ideas. Having the government intervene to shape companies and the economy, an approach long sneered at by free market economies as a Parisian obsession with a poor track record of picking corporate winners, is back in vogue. Around the globe, countries are bankrolling new industries from chip making to green energy. Breton pointed to the futility of defending pure pro-market ideals when governments around the world have taken much more active roles in directing economies. "It's the end of naivete," Breton said. "Was Europe naive towards China? Of course, of course." China funneled subsidies worth as much as 1.7% of gross domestic product to domestic businesses in 2019, compared with 0.4% of GDP for Germany and the U.S., according to a 2022 report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based think tank. "The best is less state intervention. But if other players don't cooperate, you need to shift tactics," said Dirk Schumacher, an economist with French bank Natixis. Stephanie Yon-Courtin, a French member of the European Parliament from the same political group as Breton, said, "Words like industrial policy, resilience, strategic autonomy are no longer taboo. It's definitely a change of paradigm." Instead of solely focusing on national subsidies, Breton would like the EU to spend a lot more as a bloc. He previously called for a sovereignty fund financed by joint borrowing to support the EU's response to the US Inflation Reduction Act. The sovereignty fund is on the back burner for now, slapped down by Germany and other member states. EU leaders continue to debate how much exactly should go into the defense industry, and some of Breton's other efforts to favor European companies have been vetoed during the bloc's internal decision-making process. Critics say the risk for Europe is that it wastes billions of taxpayer dollars on projects or sectors that don't become self-sustaining or competitive. That would further undermine the continent's costly social welfare model and leave Europeans poorer and not richer. For automobiles, one of Europe's top exports, the industry is intertwined with other key sectors such as semiconductors and batteries, both areas in focus for subsidies. "I'm not saying there aren't benefits from saving parts of Europe's car industry," said Jacob Kierkegaard, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. "The question is, at what price?" Battery producers, meanwhile, are still prioritizing the U.S., over Europe because the money is there on the table and the rules are easy to understand, said Renault's De Meo. Only Northvolt has taken advantage of the EU's matching subsidies so far. Our next article: how an ordinary guy took a $3,000 case to the Supreme Court. This article is by Ben Foldy. In the coming weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to issue eagerly awaited decisions on abortion, firearms, and the extent of Donald Trump's executive privilege. Another decision will also be eagerly anticipated by Stuart Harrow. The Department of Defense employee is waiting to find out whether a missed email spells an end to his 11-year quest to get $3,000 of pay and interest he says he was wrongly withheld from during the 2013 budget cuts that briefly forced him out of work. His case would feel right at home in small claims court. But in March, the 9 justices of the highest court in the land heard oral arguments about whether the government should let him continue his fight for 6 days of back pay. With the 9 justices lined up on the bench, Justice Neil Gorsuch wondered how the issue had come to this. "Here we are in the Supreme Court of the United States over a $3,000 claim," said Gorsuch. "I'm just wondering why the government's making us do this." The legal answer trudges a decades-long path, including a 3-person federal board that couldn't make quorum for 5 years. There was a missed email to an abandoned account. And there was the question taken up by the Court of Justice what Congress meant by the words "pursuant to." The human answer is that Harrow, 73, hasn't given up. Largely representing himself, Harrow has seen his appeal be rejected by the Defense Department, an administrative law judge, and a federal board. A federal court of appeals refused to hear his case due to a missed deadline. The case etching Harrow's name in the annals of jurisprudence considers only whether that deadline is so inflexible that it would prevent his claim from ever getting a stay in court. It isn't the first time that the Supreme Court was asked to render a decision on something that might seem beneath it. In 1893, the court ruled that for tax purposes, tomatoes actually are vegetables. In 1924's U.S. versus 95 barrels, more or less, of alleged apple cider vinegar, the nine justices took up whether there was a meaningful difference between vinegars made from dried apples instead of fresh. Turns out there was. Despite its seemingly low stakes, Harrow's case has real implications for ordinary people's access to the courts, say his advocates and those filing briefs in support. Harrow has worked for nearly four decades at the Defense Contract Management Agency. He also serves as president of his union chapter. The department denied Harrow permission to speak to the press while his appeal is pending. In 2013, cuts to the federal budget first forced furloughs on hundreds of thousands of government employees. Harrow applied for a hardship exemption, arguing that the discontinuous six-day furlough prevented him from finding other work to make up for the lost pay, but it did kickstart something of an amateur legal career. The law, to an extent, runs in Harrow's blood. His father, Irving, attended Brooklyn Law School, and according to family law, failed the New York bar exam after the family home was burglarized the night before. Harrow's father failed twice more before foregoing a career in the law to becoming a real estate assessor for the city. Harrow's claim was eventually heard in 2015 by the three-person Merit Systems Protection Board, a little-known agency that rules on cases of federal employees who feel they were treated unfairly. There, his effort was sidelined by political and bureaucratic dysfunction. As Harrow contested the furlough, the board lost its quorum, and that lasted until 2022 when it rejected Harrow's claim. Harrow had 60 days to appeal, but he missed the deadline. His agency had changed email servers, and he didn't receive notice of the decision. Harrow filed an appeal combining self-effacing humor, eclectic scholarship, and authorial flourishes like the petrichor of a fresh rain, but the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit Court ruled it couldn't hear the case due to the missed deadline. Undeterred, Harrow enlisted two California law professors to take his case to the Supreme Court. Scott Dodson, who runs the Center for Litigation and Courts at the University of California College of Law in San Francisco, believed the court would hear the case as part of its effort to clear up confusion over the flexibility of court deadlines and similar rules. And that will conclude our reading of articles from the Wall Street Journal for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. For Radio Reading Services, this is Greg Sillins wishing you a great day.